Friday. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Future Friday with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. And for this week, we are speaking about the future of interactions. So we're basically speaking about more the kind of human-to-human contact. And we're kind of like speaking kind of before COVID happened and how we kind of normally interact with each other. And then we're going to talk about kind of the effects of how COVID has kind of changed the way we interact and how certain businesses have actually been affected by COVID. So yeah, really interesting topic, really interesting things we're going to be talking about. And again, something quite different from what we usually talk about here on Future Friday. So John, my first kind of question to you is, how did we kind of normally interact before COVID? Like, what kind of things do we kind of do as human beings in terms of interaction?
It's kind of funny you have to ask it that way, because it really does feel like it was ages ago, back when we were actually allowed to, you know, go out to a cafe and even share the same coffee with someone.
Yeah, definitely.
It's mostly, you know, we got to, the way we socialized with other people was we were either at the workplace, you know, around other people physically, either in the office or at the store or wherever. And then, you know, you also met people at school. You know, it's actually sitting down in a lecture hall or in a classroom with your fellow classmates. And of course, there's all the other places. You go to restaurants and socialize. You go to movie theaters. We did things outside. We did things together, and it wasn't as much concern for physical distancing.
Of course.
And whether or not whether or not someone was sick. You know, if you had a cold, you know, the expectation was like, you know, do what you can. If you're fine to go outside, do what you can, and don't actively try to get other people sick, and do what you can to, you know, keep under wraps. And if you're too sick to be out, stay home. But if, you know, a little bit, you're fine.
It's true, actually.
I mean, it's still the same thing with a cold, but I think it'll be different. People will take health more seriously until we have this under control.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's kind of funny now how before this kind of pandemic happened, it was like, let's say you just had like a normal cold. You might have like a sniffly nose and things like that. It kind of can spread, but it's not to a damaging degree to like death, for example. But now, as soon as someone's kind of having a cold or someone's feeling a little bit ill, they're a bit like, 100% isolate straight away. You know, it's that 100% change into how we treat things, which is very fascinating. That's a bad way to say it, but like, you know what I mean? It's interesting to see the change of human perception now of health and interaction as well. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just going to agree that, you know, you have anything or even just a totally unrelated symptom and you're like, do I have COVID?
Yeah, no, exactly. I agree. It was kind of weird. I think the first few weeks, I would say one day I was feeling a little bit dizzy and I was like, this is a bit weird. But then the next day it kind of went away. I was kind of questioning, was like, did I have it and stuff? It's weird, especially how like we see it on the media and stuff. It's quite a weird thing.
Yeah, well, it's a developing situation. There's always something new coming out. So you never really know. We're always finding out more about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think another way how we kind of interact as well is in like sports as well. So for example, going to like a football or soccer match. So for example, I love going to watch, you know, football, soccer, and it's fantastic. But then now that, well, even though in England, we're trying to restart our football season, it's very weird, in a weird timing right now. So things like, for example, playing sports behind closed doors is now being asked. And it's quite a weird, very weird kind of weird setting that's happening now. And even like air travel, like people like used to love traveling around the world, you know, it used to be so easy. You didn't have to, like, when you go into another country, you didn't have to isolate for 14 days, which is happening in the UK now. And like things like that, it's completely changed. Like so many different dynamics and so many different interactions have changed hugely, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, these are the measures you have to take for a pandemic, but they're not, they're changes, but I don't think they'll be permanent changes. Mm. You know, it's, I mean, these are what we're doing right now because this is the best we can do. But, you know, as time goes on and as we invest more and more time, energy and resources into, you know, learning more about it and to, you know, developing vaccines and whatever else we can, eventually it's, you know, in the next, you know, they say it's a vaccine could come out in, you know, in about 2 years or, you know, 18 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we go down a path where that does happen, or, you know, we can get a vaccine for it or find some other kind of, you know, antiviral that we can use to, that's effective against it, we'll have a much different situation. Mm. Now it could be totally possible that, you know, at some point it mutates or whatever, and we don't, you know, and we can't make a vaccine or we can't do whatever, it becomes more dangerous. That's always a possibility. But I think it's more likely that, you know, within the next 2 years, you know, or within the future, we'll create, we'll have some kind of solution that will minimize it, mm. and make it more, much more controllable. So I don't think, so whether or not we're like the things and shutdowns we see now and the impact it's having, is that going to be around, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Mm. You know, we might see some remnants of it and some things that, you know, that emerge from it as a reaction, but I don't think we'll see a lot of many impacts that are direct, that have a direct connection to it.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah, I know what you mean. I think especially with your, with the point about kind of finding the vaccine, there's been so much like variety of information saying, like someone was saying it was like either 12 months, someone was saying 18 months, someone was saying 2 years. Even someone came out and said, we might not even have a vaccine for this, which was quite a weird thought to have. Very, very weird to like come out and say that. I don't know who came out and said that, but I remember someone saying, you know, we might not even get a vaccine. I know in England, they're talking.
Sorry? Assume it. Yeah. It is a possibility. We shouldn't assume. We shouldn't assume that everything can be. Is going to, you know, get away with a vaccine.
Mm, absolutely. And sometimes maybe the vaccine might not even work. You never know. Or in some cases, maybe there is a drug that can treat it. Obviously, you look at the United States right now with, I can't remember how to pronounce it. There's that drug going out in the United States, even though I think Donald Trump stopped using it. But that was saying, there were some rumors to say that was could cure coronavirus. But again, it's dodgy, the information about that. Yeah. No. But anyway, actually, let's try and go back to more like the interactions part. We kind of mentioned about how has kind of COVID changed certain ways about how we interact with people. But do you want to like maybe mention a few of these, John? Like how has COVID changed the way we interact with people?
Well, I think that depends on where you are and how COVID is impacting you. Mm. For example, you're in London in the UK and I'm in New Brunswick in Canada. New Brunswick has the whole province has a total of 122 cases last I checked.
Okay.
That's in total. I think we have one active case right now and they're almost all related to travel. There's very little community spread here. So while we have, they shut down all non-essential businesses and retail. You know, they were pretty strict and heavy handed right when it came out, but over time, and as it's been more controlled, the mood and the sentiment here has definitely shifted. It's I feel like it's more relaxed. You know, people are still like social distancing and physically distancing in stores and whatnot, but it's people are a lot more, it doesn't feel as stressful anymore, and people aren't as on edge or anxious. And, or there's a, say for example, there's a playground down the street from where I'm living, right by a lake with a beach.
Mm.
Now, partly because the weather has been getting a lot nicer and people are out. But, you know, I would drive by and that playground would be closed and no one would be there. Now the playground is still closed, but people are going there and, you know, hanging out on the beach. You know, partly because the weather's a lot nicer, but it's, people are relaxed. Sometimes when I walk out or, you know, drive down the street, it kind of, you know, I sometimes forget that there's a pandemic.
Mm.
So I'm certain, but that's how it feels right here in somewhere we're fortunate enough to have a very under control situation. But I can imagine that, you know, in London or in many places across in the United States, you know, it's a much different situation.
Yeah, absolutely. People are
going to take it much more seriously, and it's going to impact what they can and can't do a lot more.
Yeah. 100%. I think just to add to you with our case in London, yeah, it's I don't know. I think at the beginning it was strange, similar to how New Brunswick was at the beginning. Yeah, London was very, very weird. It seemed everyone was very cautious, everyone looking at each other very dodgily, and just it seemed very weird in terms of how we interacted with each other. But then as soon as I think we started launching the plans in terms of trying to ease the lockdown, it seems it's gone gradually a little bit more, I wouldn't say relaxed completely, because right now in the UK, we've had 267,240 cases. So that's the total amount of cases, which I'm looking at right now. Deaths are 37,460, which it's a lot. Where you compare that to Canada, it's pretty, like, you know, massive disparity between that. And then in terms of active cases, I'm not too sure how many cases there are in terms of activeness, but in that sense, yeah, UK has been definitely affected by it. I mean, we're one of the largest, we're one of the countries that has the most deaths right now in Europe, which is pretty staggering. You know, it's down to multiple factors, of course, but, you know, it definitely has been weird. But in terms of the social interactions, yeah, we have been socially distancing. I think there's been a lot of that being taken seriously. Even though I'd say that there's people who still go to beaches as well. So we are allowed to, for example, take a day trip somewhere. Are we allowed to do that, which is good. I mean, a lot more people have been doing it, which might cause a second spike. We don't know, but it seems like it's okay. But at the same time, we have to be very careful. But in general, like, we're able to kind of meet one person outside of our household. And from my personal experience, I did that yesterday. And that was a very, very weird experience, because we had to social distance. We were in the woods, and that, yeah, it just felt very weird. So it's just trying to adapt to this social distancing and, you know, just trying to go back to, like, you know, normality. It's going to be very weird. And yeah, I felt very weird back in London doing it.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's that's what I mean. It's going to affect different people in different places differently. It's however much it's, you know, it doesn't affect everyone everywhere the same way. And that's going to change how the long-term implications of the pandemic. You know, we're going to, no, it's going to be different for different places.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, absolutely. I feel like when countries went in earlier into lockdown, they've actually come out a lot more earlier as well. So it really depends on when countries also go into lockdown. You know, if, for example, China obviously went into lockdown much, much earlier before Western Europe. And now they've kind of gone back to a form of normality-ish. And then New Zealand apparently haven't got any active cases, and they're just gradually going back to normality. I've seen in Dubai, for example, they've opened gyms. So they're in different countries and different sets are in different processes pretty much.
Once you basically establish a closed border and you have control of the situation within it, then it can very much go back to normal and or start going back to what was normal. And I feel like that's kind of the situation where I am right now in New Brunswick, but I know, say, Montreal, it's very different and many other places. So that's the long-term impact. So whether or not it's going to have a significant impact on us, it's mostly a matter of like, okay, well, where is that going to get reflected in culture in the future? But
yeah,
for the most part, I think for most people, this will be a very strange phase, but it will be a phase and we'll, for the most part, go back to normal. We are inherently social and physical creatures. We like, you know, it's weird to not do these things. I don't think this is going to be the death of the handshake.
Yeah, no, that's the truth, actually. That's what I was thinking. Will we handshake people anymore? You know, are we going to do something different? Like what are we going to do in that? How are we going to meet people? Are we going to hug them? Are we going to kiss them on the cheek and stuff? I don't know. What's going to happen? Yeah. Yeah. That'll be interesting to see. Definitely. But yeah, I mean, we kind of actually, because you mentioned about kind of Montreal being treated differently to like New Brunswick in Canada, how has each province kind of, obviously, depending on which provenance and how many cases they have, like how different is it? Because in the UK, we obviously have more of a central system. So, you know, Parliament in London decides what happens in England, and then Scotland can decide how they do it. And then Northern Ireland can decide how they do it. And then Wales can decide how they do it. With like Canada, how have they been kind of doing it depending on each province?
It's up to the each province to regulate it. Health's a provincial jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But it's, it's very different. But that's largely a reflection mostly of Canada's geography. Well, we have 10 provinces and 3 territories, but 2/3 of the population live in just 2 provinces, Ontario and Quebec.
Yeah.
Ontario is the largest in terms of population, but Quebec has the vast majority of Canada's cases. We have about nearly 88,000 cases, and Quebec has about 49,000. Wow. So they have over half of all our cases. Meanwhile, the Ontario has nearly 27,000 cases. But then the third most cases is Alberta with 6,900. And then you have, I'm in New Brunswick with 123. EI has 27. The territories before anyone could get in, because they simply do not have the capacity to deal with it if they ended up getting there. So there are no cases there. They've shut down the border, and that's kind of what I kind of was talking about before. They've shut down the border, but they haven't, I don't know what they're doing. I don't think there's much going on in terms of physical distancing. I don't know. But at the same time, their weather's different. So they spent, they might not even, it might not get much daylight time at this time of year.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's
just so north. I don't know what it's like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, that's the thing. Why has maybe it's down to like population size, but then why has like Quebec got the most? This is the thing. I don't know. Like maybe it's because
Well, most of them are in, most of our deaths are in nursing homes, and that's largely where it's been in Quebec. Quebec has been notorious for it. I think there's even one nursing home that made international news where it was like they found the staff had basically abandoned these the elderly there, and they were left, in soil. Like basically, when they were found, like many of them were found. I think 32 people had died, and like many of them, when they found them, were like left in like soiled. Like they hadn't been like cleaned or like washed, and they had not been taken care of, or like even been fed, and dehydrated.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's largely been in, say, like nursing homes and affecting the elderly the most. That's where it's been, for the most part, across the country. The country's really starting to wake up about, the reforms for long-term healthcare. But Quebec's also one of the provinces kind of leading the charge in opening up. Mm. But that's, I think, is also partly because Montreal is a very different situation than the rural parts of the province. It's largely in Montreal, the epidemic.
Yeah.
So, but the ruling party is largely based in rural Quebec.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So they're like, hey, we want to open up. So like, okay, well, our constituents want to open up, so we're going to open up. But Montreal, they're like, not a single riding in Montreal voted for this party.
Really? Oh my God.
Yeah.
So, wow, that's really interesting now. God. Yeah. No, when I'm going off for your point about the like nursing homes, yeah, we kind of have the same situation where, yeah, nursing homes were having a lot of deaths because of COVID. So it's kind of like internationally as well, which seems pretty bad. Yeah.
But at the same time, in terms of, to further illustrate my point of it being more relaxed here, even though nursing homes are across Canada are the ones who are feeling the brunt of COVID the most, because it's so under control in New Brunswick, because we have so few cases. While my grandfather, he can't visit his partner he can't go into the nursing home to visit her anymore, and she can't leave the nursing home.
Yeah.
He can't, like, basically they're like, they go and like meet at the window and like socially distance through the window and talk through an open window. Partly because it's a lot, the weather's a lot nicer, but also just, it's more relaxed here.
Of course.
It's just, we can't say for certain, but we're all quite, we can say with good confidence that, no one within 20K of us has it.
Yeah.
Now, whether that might breed complacency, and could that lead to a second wave? Sure. But right now, we have our borders shut for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, internationally as well, you've got borders shut for Canada as well. So it's, in that sense, it's all good. We can definitely talk a bit more about, the industries that will be impacted by this pandemic. And, I think industries like restaurants, hospitality, places that we normally go out and socialize in have been impacted hugely. So, do you want to talk a bit more about that, John? About what kind of places have been impacted by this pandemic?
Yeah, well, in terms of social businesses and places we go to interact, we go and interact a lot of, we go to movie theaters and we go to restaurants. We go to, we have coffee dates. We go and meet people over food and do all these things together.
Yeah.
But, that could be hard for businesses to, to do that and sustain themselves while social distancing. If a restaurant can only let in half capacity, well, if you're a small restaurant to start and you can only have one customer two at a time.
Yeah.
You're not going to make money for that. You can't make money off that.
Mm. I've actually got some information, actually. So, for example, in Italy, they've been trying to say to their customers to keep physically distant within restaurants or within pubs and bars. And Australia actually limits, customers are limited in Australia to 1 per 4 square meters. And 10 drinkers are only allowed on site. So it's like, how are these businesses going to operate within half capacity and within places which is going to be very difficult to try and how are you going to try and maintain a socially distant environment within a very socially interactive place? You know, it's that question. I don't know how you're going to do it. 100%.
Yeah. Well, it's, I think, you know, if you're a large restaurant and you have the space for it, you probably can get by, but it's, it really depends. But I think one thing we might see in North America is potentially a shift towards more European style business hours.
Mm.
Like in North American restaurants, it's generally, you know, if they're open for say breakfast, lunch and dinner, they'll be open from say, 7 a.m., 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. You know, they'll be open in that entire time, or maybe they'll just be open for, you know, lunch and supper and, you know, say 11 to 11.
Yeah.
But, and a lot of places in Europe and the continent will be open just for lunch and dinner. They'll be open from 12 to 2 and then 7 to 9.
Yeah, they could do that.
So if you have shorter, you know, if you have sort of an economic perspective, if you have a limited, if there's only a limited amount of time for when people can actually go to get something, then there's more people, then people are more likely to all go at that time than to go whenever they want if they have that option. Store might offer, you know, a 10% off on a specific day of the week, so they can have most of their staff at that one time rather than having to try and spread it out throughout the week.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that'll be interesting to look into, like how North America might change in that sense, just to kind of go about changing the hours and changing how they kind of operate and stuff. Definitely. And I also have a good example from the UK. So I don't know if you know this pub called Wetherspoons. So it's basically a British pub chain, and they've actually invested, because they're a very big chain, so they've invested a lot of money into trying to create social distancing kind of procedures. So they invested 11 million into their pubs to try and make these kind of things happen. So these include face masks and protective eyewear for their staff, and also a reduced menu, and also the pubs having 10 hand sanitizer stations and perspex screens indoors to allow social distancing as well. So that's what one pub is trying to do, which is a massive chain. But there's also calls for, you know, trying to reduce the distance rule. So instead of having two meter social distancing rule, they're trying to do it to 1 meter distance rule, because they feel like that's going to at least allow more business in, whilst also trying social distance, because they'd feel that 2 meters isn't going to be liable enough. Because you go into a pub and you're standing very far away from your friends, it's a bit weird. I think customers won't be wanting to go into pubs if that's happening. Whereas a 1 meter rule might allow more customers in. That's what's been argued by places like BrewDog, which is like a it's like a pub chain around the world, basically. So that's what they were arguing. So it seems like even though restaurants might go towards these restrictions, some might actually want to try and go against them, try and find a way to allow profit, but also try and allow free social distancing, which would be interesting. I think it would be a very difficult way to try and navigate around themselves.
No, it's interesting that you use the examples of these large chains, because I think they're the... you know, you have large chains and there's also a lot of independents and smaller family restaurants. And I think those, you know, large chains, you know, McDonald's, places like that, they're all going to be able to, they can afford to make the investments into changing, into making these long-term changes. And to, you know, they can afford these investments to transform the restaurants, and they can take the hits of, you know, reduced business capacity. Or, you know, they'll find some other arrangement. They'll start
advertising more,
like Uber Eats or whatever, you know, or
yeah.
Maybe a lot of restaurants will move towards that. But in terms of like smaller family restaurants, that might be, you know, we might see it, you know, I don't, they'll definitely struggle more depending on what kind of, you know, business support exists in different countries.
Yeah, I think we'll see a. I definitely feel like we're going to see, I think, a lot more small businesses really struggle, and I think maybe shutting down. Because already, well, we were mentioning before coming on here about Thunder and Lightning, which is a small kind of bar slash pub in Sackville, shutting down completely because of it. And how I mentioned about Black Duck as well, which had to kind of shut down because of those, small local businesses. Unfortunately, are unable to kind of run. I also know another business in Sackville, who I've talked to personally on CHMA for a radio station. He's kind of struggling as well to try and keep up and sell stuff. Even when he's trying to put social distancing, people who go into the shop have to wear a mask, and he's trying to enforce it, but customers who don't have a mask don't go into the store, and that's going to be losing profit. So it's I completely agree with you. It's the fact that how do you try and find a way to allow businesses to run as much as they can whilst also abiding by social distancing and these health proceedings? It's very difficult, and I think some will succeed, but I think a large majority won't succeed generally. And do you, I don't know, I'm my personal opinion, I don't know if this is the thing. I understand why we need some procedures in place because of what's going on. But do you feel like certain procedures should be there though? Like, honest opinion, like if, yeah, like honestly, I don't know if I feel like these procedures should exist, especially if we put in place like Sackville, New Brunswick, where you have barely any cases there. Should we have these sort of procedures in place? Whereas, okay, if we have in London, then that makes sense, but certain areas might not have that many cases. So it's like, I don't know. I don't feel like maybe certain procedures are necessary. I don't know. This is the thing. I don't feel like, because we're going to see so many small businesses being shut down because of a pandemic, which might affect more places than others, you know? So I don't know. I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to say, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, that's part of the problem is whenever you have, jurisdictions with very different places. Vancouver is in the same province as, all these small towns, very, very different. They're all going to be regulated by the province. So yeah, that's in the UK, it's a unitary system. If, what London, I have a friend in Oxford who's saying like, hey, we're pretty relaxed here. We're pretty fine. We also have, the best, hospital in the entire country because of the university. So we're pretty okay. But it's London that's, it's Parliament in London that's telling us that we can't do certain things because because it's London that's being affected. So yeah, there's always those issues where you want to, delegate authority to lower levels so people can better govern, choose how they want to, what they do for themselves. But I think one thing that people need to, I think one thing people always forget or is that businesses and the economy are dynamic. Yes, businesses will struggle, and yes, businesses will disappear, but businesses will also, reemerge and reappear and take new forms. To fill those voids. Now, whether now we should support these people to make sure they have, their livelihoods and they can still do what they want, but it might take a different form. Like maybe, for example, maybe we'll move toward maybe open markets might become a better might become more popular, especially since open streets are across the world are opening up more and more, and they might stay that way. And so, maybe for an example, restaurants move their seating to the outdoors. Once you have your outdoors and you have open air, things can be different. You can have, you can it can be a little more relaxed. You don't have to be as strict because that's because the part of the issue is, you're inside and you're in a confined space with limited air circulation. Well, if you're outside, you have wind, it can be very different. They'll probably still abide by, social distancing and other changes, but it might be more relaxed.
Yeah.
And so, or maybe, you know, you have a shop front and you have it outside as a market, and you have it, you have these open squares. You know, we can have these changes to how both businesses operate and to our communities, having something that's outside and maybe a little more communal. But that could also, of course, be totally limited by, you know, your weather and your geography. You know, this is, you know, that, you know, open restaurants and open seating sounds great in, you know, sounds great in the summer, but, you know, if you're in winter and it's snowy and windy,
yeah,
you know, you might be able to get some heat lamps, and that can maybe, you know, get you by on, you know, some days, but that can be different. You know, maybe it's, maybe restaurants become more of, or these little mom and pop shop restaurants become more of a seasonal business.
Mm. Have you also seen, in the Netherlands, I don't know if you've seen this viral video of like greenhouses being turned into a restaurant. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
Did you not? Okay, yeah. So I think it was in the Netherlands. So it was reported on the BBC where they're showing this restaurant. They kind of bought a few greenhouses. So they fitted in like two people into these greenhouses, and they could literally pass food into the greenhouse, all socially distancing. And then the waiters were wearing these protective masks as well. And they were all doing it via that way. It's quite weird to describe, but yeah, the thing was in the Netherlands where they were doing it. It was quite a cool experience. So that was one way of trying to like showcase a restaurant being different and trying to change it. So yeah, that was quite, so yeah, if you want to look it up. It's quite interesting actually to see. So yeah, that was one way of how they were doing it. But yeah, I know what you mean by the fact like, the summer months as well, because if you're in a greenhouse, like I'll go back to this example of the greenhouse, if it's in the summer, you're going to be baking hot. That's the issue with what the Netherlands was doing, or this one particular restaurant in the Netherlands was doing, was if it's really boiling hot, what happens to the greenhouse? And that's, and then with your point about the seasonal going more like more of a seasonal trade, I think that's interesting as well. Very, very interesting to hear, because we might see that maybe, but yeah.
But then again, I want to go back to my previous point about, you know, if we, you know, find a vaccine or something else, you know, I think in, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, we'll probably see the new forms of businesses that emerged from COVID. But I think we'll still, you know, we'll, once it's safe again, we'll probably still be able to go back and, maybe not to the same restaurants exactly, but
yeah,
we'll still have restaurants where you can go inside any time of the year, sit down at a table in a confined space.
Definitely. Mm. And just lastly, what are the long-term, we kind of spoke a little bit about the impact, the long-term impacts, but yeah, like what are the long-term impacts of COVID, do you feel? And if you want to go away from restaurants, that's fine. But yeah, what are kind of the long-term impacts of COVID?
Well, I saw an interesting video the other day kind of discussing how the Spanish flu changed many, changed the home and introduced many aspects and materials of the home that we take, you know, that are, we consider standard now, that were largely introduced at, or as a response to the Spanish flu. So largely thinking, for example, using materials such as tile and linoleum in bathrooms and kitchens rather than wood, to make sure that they can actually, to make the areas cleaner, make them easier to clean, as or and to stop using wallpaper. And this is also the same time when the half bath in the bathroom became more prevalent. So like having more bathrooms in the house where you can, you know, wash your hands and touch up and like, you know, be clean. So I think what we'll see is, you know, in terms of like long-term impacts, I think that'll really depend on how long a place has to deal with these, has to deal with these social distancing measures. You know, for example, like say Nunavut, for example, I don't think they're making a lot of changes. I don't know. I would imagine they're not making a lot of changes, and it's not going to really, you know, substantially impact their change, you know, how they're doing things 5 years from now. But, you know, if we're in larger cities, and if there's a large city, like New York that gets, that has this going on, let's say that goes on for a year and a half or 2 years, you know, that could, in some communities, it could be something, you know, a traumatic experience that they're going to remember for generations. While other ones, you know, it might just be like, oh yeah, remember that, like there was a pandemic. That was a thing.
Yeah, true. It'll definitely be in part of like the history books, later years, 100%. And I think what's interesting, I don't know if you've been seeing this, but also mental health has probably had a bit of an impact as well, during this pandemic as well, which is pretty bad to see. I definitely think the consequences of this, or the long-term impacts, will be a lot more of a concentration of health, not just physical health, but also mental health. I mean, already mental health is taken quite seriously now, but I think mental health will now be taken even more seriously, because of the fact that, because we were so restricted in our households, the fact that we were able to go outside really once, that shows that we're going to try and take our health even more seriously and are more of a mental health to try and go outside more to express ourselves out of isolation. So I definitely think the long-term sort of impacts is that I think we're going to try and take things less for granted as well, and trying to take our health more seriously, especially the fact that COVID was more or less impacting people who had health conditions or underlying health conditions, and also the older generation as well. So we have to be very like wary of that as well when going into the future as well.
No, yeah, I agree. It's blanked.
No, sorry, don't worry about it. It's fine. I thought you were going to say something, but yeah, no, it's
I had something. It totally left. What were you just saying again?
Okay, no, it's okay. So I was kind of just saying, like, I kind of feel that we've been taking our health for like granted.
Oh yes, mental health.
Yep, go ahead. Yeah,
I remember now. Yeah. No, I agree. It's definitely, we'll definitely be start taking both our physical and mental health more seriously. I think people are really realizing just how important, their lot, you know, how important their social well-being has an impact on their health, mm-hmm. and how much that, how impactful and how important it is. And to realize that, I think a lot of people are also kind of realizing like, hey, no, I don't have to be hustling all the time. I don't have to be doing all this stuff all the time. Like, it's actually kind of nice to take a little break and to have some downtime and to,
yeah, you know what? I actually agree with that
for oneself.
Because it's like, I felt before this pandemic happened, everyone was going, you know, 90 miles per hour in life, you know, going full intent to their jobs, all their university careers, or all their livelihoods, right? Going very, very fast. And all of a sudden this pandemic just hit and it slowed everything down. And maybe, and I'm not saying like we needed a pandemic to slow us down, or like I think maybe we needed some sort of element that would have just changed the world, slowed everything down. And maybe it was a sign to say to us, like, maybe we need to slow down and maybe we need to take some things for granted. Not to say like, oh, a pandemic was good. I'm just saying like something similar that would stop everything and slow everything down. Maybe it was a sign to us that we needed to, we were taking some certain things for granted. If you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. It's, I think it helps us see and kind of taking a moment to sit back and pause, kind of give us a moment to, reevaluate our priorities, to realize the things that we were once stressing so much about aren't so bad, or, you know, that we can afford to slow down. You know, the world isn't on fire yet, at least depending on where you live, but, you know, the world isn't on fire. If we're still around, you know, yes, businesses is shut down, but, you know, we're still chugging. We're still here. Maybe, maybe we totally could have afforded to, or can afford to shut things down in terms of, to deal with climate change. You know, we're still around.
Yeah.
We don't have to, we don't have to go at 110 all the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. Definitely. Do you have anything else to say before we go to weak signals, or are you good?
Nope, you're good.
Yep. Okay, cool. We'll go to our weak signals then. So I'll go first. So I found a really interesting weak signal for this week from Boston University, suggesting that blue light could help fight against antibiotic-resistant diseases. So this was on Futurity. So basically, the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention basically have been seeing 2.8 million antibiotic-resistant infections in the United States every single year. And this has resulted in 35,000 deaths every year. So it's a pretty big, serious issue. And things like MRSA causes more than half of these deaths. So these are like kind of viruses that have, you know, antibiotic resistant sort of antibodies. Let's just say that. I don't know the exact scientific name for it, but it's basically resistance to antibodies and antibiotics. There you go. My bad. And now, which is really great, is that researchers have found a way to try and temporarily weak the defense of MRSAs, all these kind of types of pathogens, which is fantastic. And they've actually looked into and saw blue light could be a way to actually do this. So they found how blue light was able to wipe out 90% of MRSA cells. And then they had to use, and then for the last 10%, they used blue light photolysis and then a dose of hydrogen peroxide. And this combination eradicated 99.9% of the MRSA colony. So really great news. It kind of shows that when they actually used blue lights, it made no damage to skin or surrounding tissues. So there's been like an ongoing debate with blue light, you know, if it's harmful to us or if it's not harmful for us. And this kind of shows that blue light could actually help damage against diseases and also not creating any damage to our skin or surrounding tissues. And so it just demonstrates a new way to tackle diseases and a really big breakthrough in treating them. So yeah, very interesting weak signal published by Boston University. So yeah, John, what do you think about this?
No, that's good. That's great in that, you know, the more we use antibiotics, the more resistant they become. You know, there's I think the slogan of an antibiotic drug campaign in British Columbia was "Not all bugs need drugs."
Oh, really?
You know, that's also the same reasoning why, you know, when the doctor prescribes you an antibiotic, you take all of the antibiotics so that there isn't anything that can, you know, you don't get that little bit that actually can survive it and then mutates and, you know, oh look, now it's more resistant to the antibiotic, you know, I have an even worse bug.
Of course.
So, you know, having things that, you know, as fewer and fewer as our antibiotics become less and less effective, it's really important that we can have better and better ways to, and different ways to deal with them. So hopefully photolysis can be applicable to other diseases than just, and other bacteria than just MRSA is methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
That's it. Yeah, so, I was thinking of pronouncing it, and I was like, nope. I am not going to pronounce it. So
yeah,
like, yeah, no, it's it was really interesting. And blue light is, yeah, it's an interesting thing because I think there's always an ongoing debate about blue light. I don't know if you know about this, but blue light, for example, is seen in our like phone screens, and sometimes they can have a bad effect. So for example, like on our sleep patterns, and there's even some research, it's not like completely conclusive yet, but it's suggesting that it could have some impacts on our skin. But again, there's still ongoing research about if blue light does have that damage. But yeah, I think blue light in this way shows that blue light can actually be very beneficial for us if that's trying to harm or trying to destroy these kind of pathogens. But yeah, no, it's interesting. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what's your weak signal then, John?
I have a shoe that could make running faster and easier. So this is from Vanderbilt University. They published a model that could theoretically increase running speeds by 50%. So they ran various theoretical designs into computer models, and they discovered that a spring-powered device attached to the legs was the best design. And this the model would store energy by compressing a spring when the runner lifts and bends their trailing leg, and is released when the foot hits the ground. And the springs could even be programmable to increase resistance as the runner picks up speed, like gears on a bike. And so the initial prototypes are exoskeletons, but the end goal would be compressing this the whole system down into spring-powered shoes.
Nice.
So this is really, you know, this can be quite impactful, as the mechanical exoskeletons could dramatically improve the viability of walking as a mode of transportation. So there are already, you know, other exoskeletons in development that could boost speed by 10%, but, you know, 50% could be revolutionary. You know, gains 50% could let people walk at nearly 8 kilometers an hour. Or would allow Usain Bolt to run at about 80 kilometers an hour. And if people could jog, you know, if people could jog at the pace of a slow car, you know, these exoskeletons could really be used for, say, like the last leg of a commute, or even replace transit by increasing the range of what's considered walkable.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well.
And if spring-loaded designs can be miniaturized into shoes, then it can become a standard feature in shoes, giving everyone a boosted walking speed with no external energy resources. But, you know, there are also some safety concerns. You know, it's kind of like giving every, safety concerns like a bike.
Yeah.
You know, we're giving everyone car-like mobility, but without the protection of airbags.
Yeah. It's like, maybe there needs to be like a driving test. Like, you know how before you have to get your driver license, you need to do a test. Maybe something similar to that.
You gotta get a test to walk?
Well,
a test to run?
No, okay, no, you know what I meant. Like, to use.
I know what I mean, but yeah. I know what you're saying, but.
Yeah.
But it could be, that's the thing, is it's, you know, like if you run, if you're running right now, like at the speed you can run at now, and you bump into someone, like that hurts. Like, imagine you're doing that 50% faster.
Oh God. Yeah. True. Yeah. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe you could just have a license for these shoes. Or maybe just like, maybe there needs to be better self-awareness of people when running. That's a good gadget. I don't know. Could be. Yeah.
Hey, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Yes. No, true. But yeah, no, that sounds very interesting. But yeah, so did the university, is this more based on consumer use rather than like athlete use? So like, would we see
right
these...
Now it's just theoretical model. They just put this through a computer, and like the computer, like in our computer simulations, this design looks like it would be the most efficient.
Okay, fair enough. Sure. So it was
so
more
at this point design. They haven't done it yet, but you know, but and oftentimes, you know, people who are making these things, they usually have the good intentions and the good ideas in mind. Whether or not this would be used for anything else, that's a different question.
Of course, yeah. It's always you always have a good idea at first, and then once you actually get into it, it starts to get a little bit trickier, it seems. Fair enough. Is there anything else, John, from this? Or
no, that's that.
Perfect. All right. Thank you, John, for saying your weak signal. And yeah, it's been a great conversation about interactions, especially around this time of the pandemic. And yeah, it was super interesting. So thanks, John, for coming into this conversation. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Future Friday. You can find our other episodes on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. Sorry about that. And yeah, hope to see you guys next week. Thanks for listening. And yeah, have a good week. Bye.